So in addition to two previous albums that the composer recorded with the Boston Pops, John William Steven Spielberg, The Ultimate Collection, features some brand new material recorded not long ago in UCLA's Rice Hall. And the album also comes with a DVD. And, you know, prior to you two guys, I think, you know, the most celebrated director-composer partnership had to be Benny Herman and Alfred Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. That only went through seven pictures. Well, eight if you consider Torn Curtain, which Hitchcock threw out at the first scoring session. Mm-hmm. And it lasted for 11 years. You guys have been at it 43 years, and by my count, 26 pictures. Ah. With two in the works.
Yes. So. Well, it's been quite a good while. It must be the longest collaboration. I don't know about Mr. Rota with his Italian director.
Fellini, been, yeah. Yes, no, that Fellini. Was, you know, and he died very young.
Many films, do you know? Not so much, just a few.
Not as many as you guys.
Well, it is amazing. Of course, when one starts out working together, you never imagine that anything's going to last 5 years or let alone 40, and we're still going. It seems as though it's all been happening within a year somehow. It must mean that we're having a good time in some way.
That would seem to be
it. Yes. And there's a compatibility. It also speaks to something about Spielberg himself. He's a very, very loyal person. He's even loyal to technologies in a way. He was very reluctant to give up the 35-millimeter film practice of making cuts with a butt splicer, which is just simply a knife,
yes.
A form of a knife. And he still has a composer who writes with a pencil, which is Wamem, yours truly. But he has switched to Pro Tools and the newer technologies. But alas, I have not, Jim. So I'm still pushing my pencil on paper and giving the parts of the orchestra in the time-honored way. But it's been great fun with him. One thing I'd like to mention is that all the way from Jaws to Schindler's List, there couldn't have been a greater variety of opportunities offered to me by Steven and his projects. So it's been a great surprise in the end, and a great treat and a great honor, certainly, to be doing these things.
Yeah. So to ask you the obvious question, what did you first think when you ran into this skinny guy with glasses and more enthusiasm than any two or three earthquakes put together?
True enough. I think he looked at about 17 years old to me, as I think I've told you before. And within the first 20 minutes of our conversation, first 10, I suppose, I realized that he knew much more about film music than I did. He'd been a collector of the old LPs of Tiomkin and Rosha and all the rest of them, and can whistle all the secondary themes of all these films, and had great love for music itself. His mother recently passed away, Leah, and when they lived in Philadelphia, Leah took Stephen to the Academy of Music to hear the orchestra play. He has grown up loving music. And a little anecdote about his mother, Leah, and the score of Jaws. When Stephen was taken to the Philharmonic Orchestra as a child, Jacob Krochmalnik happened to be the concertmaster of the orchestra in that period. And Krochmalnik left the orchestra and came to the West Coast. On Stephen's first recording session with large live orchestra, Jaws, his mother, Leah, came at Stephen's invitation. And our concertmaster on the film was Jacob Krochmalnik, who she hadn't seen since Philadelphia. And she was much more impressed by the fact that Krochmalnik was in our orchestra than Stephen had made a film and had a full orchestra at his own disposal.
It's fair to call Jaws the first of the real summer blockbusters. It kind of just changed summer and movies, mm-hmm. and people jumping out of bathtubs because there's this. Speaking of jumping people, I saw it in Maine, where I was living at the time. My dad came out to see me, and we saw it at a theater in Waterville, Maine. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting next to my dad, who was a World War II D-Day survivor. He was at Normandy when Roy Scheider is chumming. First time you see the head pop up, my dad jumped 2 feet out of his seat, as did everybody in the theater. Mm-hmm. It had that effect on people.
A fantastic thing.
And nowadays you can't play da-dum and not see people jumping out of their bathtubs. I mean, it's just.
What is amazing, though, Jim, at a concert when I occasionally play the Jaws theme, and play the opening two notes, people laugh, you know. Yeah. And this I would love someone to explain to me, some psychologist perhaps would do it. And also the psycho shriek notes of Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, sure.
You know, if you play those two, people will giggle.
1977 was a pivotal year. You went into competition for the first of, I think, what, eight times when you're competing against yourself for an Oscar with Close Encounters of the Third Kind and the first Star Wars. Did you have any idea as you're doing them that these two pictures would have that kind of impact?
None whatever, Jim. Working on Star Wars, I think we all thought, well, it's a very different and very interesting piece, and kids will love it on Saturday afternoon, and then we'll move on to the next, until Joseph Campbell came along and explained to us the interconnectedness of George Lucas' myths and how it seemed to be touching all humanity. It came, I have to say, as a complete surprise to me, and possibly even to some extent to George Lucas, although we're indebted to him for his imagination. When I finished the Star Wars, the film became a tremendous hit, Jim, you know, over first opening weekend. And I didn't have time to go to the theater or even think about it because Stephen had given me Close Encounters and I was scratching my head trying to think what to do with this film. I loved it, by the way, Close Encounters. I loved the film. So the year was compressed, 1977, by two really challenging projects on top of each other. And really all I could think of was doing the best I could with each one without any time to reflect on one or the other. I don't think ever has an idea when you're writing a score that it might be nominated. You may after a while begin to continue or think to hope for that. Certainly at that point in my life, that was the farthest thing from my mind. And getting the work done was the immediate challenge. What a surprise it was that when both of them became so successful, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg back to back in the same year, creating two such groundbreaking pieces, really.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I'm not absolutely certain that the best score won, because this is the score that has my supreme lump-in-the-throat moment. In the end credits, when Steven Spielberg's name appears, there's that descending string figure, and I just lose it every time, to this day. I mean, I just can't talk. We occasionally play this during membership drives, and Rich Caporello and I, one afternoon, were talking about our favorite John Williams lump-in-the-throat moments, and we're playing it over this, and I had to duck out, you know, and just let it play. Well, I've said this behind your back often enough, so I'll say it to your face. I think you write the best marches in Sousa. You really have a knack for that. You know, did you always kind of love marches?
I don't know. My music editor, Ken Bonberg, always used to accuse me. He'd say, John will write a march at the drop of a foot. Well, so many of these films seem to have required a march tune for one reason or another. And the other part of it, Jim, was that as a youngster, you know, I was in an Air Force band for 3 years. And most of the music that I scored, I won't say orchestrated or band-strated, perhaps somebody would say, at that time was for band, for brass and winds. And I did all manner of adaptations of pop tunes and other things, finding myself in the very fortunate position that I didn't have to do KP because they could discover that I could arrange for our concert band and our marching band. So I suppose maybe some of that stuck. And I also played the brass instruments as a youngster. I played trombone, a few attempts at trumpet, even tuba. And so I suppose the combination of those experiences and the requirements by the films I was assigned led to a few marches that you can drop your feet to. One of the great bits of joy I've had from this has been performing some of these marches with the U.S. Marine Band, which is a section of wind players on the level of, I don't know, name it, Chicago Symphony. They're incredible. In fact, our present principal trumpeter of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Tom Hooton, who's actually, by the way, featured on this record, is, as I say, now our principal here in Los Angeles, is a former member of the Marine Band and is an astounding player for any of your listeners who may have heard him recently. If they haven't heard him, I'd recommend it. And playing anything with the Marine Band is to experience a kind of perfection and discipline that's rare. But I've played the 1941 march with them a few times, and I must say, it's been a hoot every time.
I would bet. The third album, which is brand new, was recorded at Royce Hall over a couple of days, not too long ago.
Right.
There's a wonderful moment from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I think it concerns the real heart of that picture. I mean, Indy is the guts of the picture, mm-hmm. and he's the brain of it. But Marion is kind of the lodestone in the middle.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And she got a great theme.
Yes. Well, thank you. I hope so. Yes, Jim. All of the material we recorded at Royce Hall was affected by the great acoustic in that hall. It's a fabulous place to play. Zubin Mehta used to record. As a matter of fact, he recorded Star Wars and Close Encounters there many years ago. And I remembered that and always enjoyed the hall. So we went up there and recorded Marion's theme along with all these other new recordings we've done. Marion has not gotten the attention that Indiana Jones has gotten.
No.
But the young lady that played the part, Karen Allen, was a particular favorite of mine. And she lives in Tanglewood, and I have seen her recently up there.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of the recordings that Zubin Mehta and the Los Angeles Philharmonic made of music from Star Wars and Close Encounters, how important was that when a major American orchestra, I think for the first time, does film music in mm-hmm. a very serious way?
Mm-hmm.
I think it made a very dramatic statement.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did make it. I don't know if there are other precedents for that at that time, late 70s. I think the energy behind all of that came from Ernest Fleischman, who I knew slightly, but he came to my house, he'd heard the scores, and he suggested that Zubin conduct them. I said, fantastic. And he also suggested that I would conduct Star Wars at the Hollywood Bowl. And I said, Ernest, no, I don't conduct in public. You have Zubin Mehta, you don't need me. No, I insist, John, you come to the Hollywood Bowl and conduct. So Ernest Fleischman was a man of many parts. But one of the things he was not was someone you can say no to.
Exactly.
and so...
Well, hence Walt Disney Concert Hall.
Exactly.
Because without Ernest, it wouldn't have been built.
It would not have happened. And next year, in 18, I'll celebrate my 40th anniversary at the Hollywood Bowl after telling Ernest that I would never do it.
Well, he was a notoriously brilliant talent spotter,
yes.
Those Ernest Fleischman.
How lucky we have been. And also Deborah Borda now, who sadly is leaving us. She will also be a tough one to replace.
You bet. So the first time I saw E.T., I stood in line with everybody else. And it was in one of the big theaters in Hollywood. I was only in line for about 3.5 hours. And I was sort of at the middle of the back mm-hmm. of the line. And I've never seen an audience react quite the same way that they reacted to that. I mean, the entire audience kind of had these semi-tears in their eyes, and their mouths were wide open, as was mine, mm-hmm. throughout the whole picture. Mm-hmm. When you first saw it at the first spotting session with Steven Spielberg, what do you think?
Well, I think it's his masterpiece. I'm not sure about that he would agree with that or others, but I always remember the performances of the children, which he'd gotten exactly right, or they'd gotten exactly right. I think we look at the film now, what is it, 30, 40 years later, and it's apart from the slight changes in the styles of automobiles, it could have been made yesterday. It's completely timeless, I think. And the imagination in the piece, Ulysses Matheson, who we recently lost, and Stephen made, I think, one of the great films, with and about children, but about imagination and the ability to dream, to fly. And when you think about, from a technical point of view, how difficult that must have been to do, there were no computer-generated images for a creature like E.T. and his comedy scenes near the fridge or the icebox there, you know, or the refrigerator, how that possibly could have been done, and so much emotion from this rubber model. There's something about that, the skill of the filmmaking there, that obliterated any challenge to the lack of technology in the filmmaking process. We believed every frame of it somehow.
Didn't we?
We absolutely did, and all of the suspicions that make creep into it, the artifice of what's being done was completely masked by photography, by the editing, by the storytelling, by hopefully some degree by the music, and the whole absurdity of the whole thing that children could reach escape velocity and fly over the moon on their bicycles was something that we completely accepted. I believe we did.
Totally.
And they land so gracefully, and you want to go out and grab your bicycle and do the same thing if you believe, you know, deeply enough. So I think it was a singular achievement for anybody in film, and I so enjoy playing the music all the time. And in the last year or two, Jim, you're probably aware that performances of the film with live orchestras have been done. I think it was done at the Bowl a year or so ago, and many cities around the world. And Philadelphia Orchestra, no less, has done it with Stephen Deneuve recently, and they will do it again this summer at Saratoga. And it seems to be a completely satisfying experience for audiences to enjoy the film and witness and experience the artistry of the orchestra contributes to the magic of an event like this. What a marvelous experience E.T. has been from beginning to end. It hasn't ended.
No, no, nor will it anytime soon. I have to say, one of your most surprising scores should not have surprised me at all, given your experiences as a jazz musician, especially in the, you know, the kind of the cool West Coast jazz of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And it all fits so well into Catch Me If You Can. Mm-hmm. In fact, you can't imagine the picture without the music, because it's integral to the picture.
A great opportunity to revisit the 60s jazz, which I dabbled in a little bit, Jim, never at the expert level of so many. It was an interesting school, a cool school, very different than what was being played on the East Coast. And Catch Me If You Can presented an opportunity to revisit all of this. And so we have the result in Escapades, which is a piece for alto saxophone vibe and string bass, acoustic bass. To do this, we need three expert players. We had Dan Higgins, who many of you listeners will know, play to do the alto saxophone part, and Mike Valerio on bass. And coming from Germany was Martin Grubinger. Do you remember Martin Grubinger, or do you know about him? I hope you do.
He's sort of the Milt Jackson.
He is incredible. He was here a few years ago with the Philharmonic and did a fabulous concerto by Tan Dan. And I must say, I've never seen or heard any percussion player with hands like this man has. And in marimba playing, four or five mallets out with accuracy up and down this instrument where every bar is a different measurement from being very thick to very thin. An amazing athletic feat. And the vibraphone part in this particular piece is very reminiscent of Milt Jackson. It's very much right on, Jim, your reminiscences of that. And Martin came all the way from Austria and did a brilliant job with us, as I knew he would. So we had an absolutely first-rate 60s jazz trio, manned by three men who probably weren't alive in the 60s, I don't think any of them. And they did such a beautiful job with it. And this was completely fun with me. It started with an animated sequence in the film of a sleuthing kind. You might have had a Henry Mancini score in the 60s doing this thing so perfectly, you know. And this was a reminiscence on my part that seemed to fit this piece. In the 60s, one might have had Shelley Mann contributing
exactly.
to a thing like this, or Bud Shank playing the parts. Now, some of your listeners will remember these names, I suspect.
Oh, my hand's up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is such a completely entertaining picture. I mean, there's just not one scene that isn't. I mean, the scene where the old guys in the print shop who finally direct Tom Hanks to France is very brief. These three old guys that do the old-fashioned two-ton, not counting the ink, print jobs. And, you know, it's just one great scene after
it's
another.
Very, very good. The only music in the film that I didn't write, which I wish I might have, is the song Come Fly With Me that Frank Sinatra sung in the film so prominently in the wonderful scene or two, which fits so perfectly.
Yeah. Nor did you write the scene where Mitch Miller comes on and conducts the...
yeah, no.
My boyhood hero, along with Mickey Mantle, because he was America's first great oboe player, which some people don't know.
It's from Eastman, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Gave the American premiere of the Strauss Oboe Concerto.
Uh-huh. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was Delancey.
Delancey gave Strauss the idea.
Yes,
but Mitch played it. Played it once. He says, "I'll never play that again. It's a tapeworm."
Remember who conducted it by him? Metropolis?
Somebody like that, or maybe Benny Herman, because Mitch was the...
Might have been.
He was the oboist in the CBS orchestra. Yes. Which,
well, I'm sure they would have clashed on many occasions.
No, they were actually pretty good friends. He was one of the few guys that Bernard Herman... Yeah. Yeah, the man that our mutual friend David Raxon called a virtuoso of unspecific anger.
He was very fond of my late wife, Barbara, yeah. who always said, oh, Benny, just shut up.
Yeah, the great Benny Herman wisecrack came from David Raxon. He said, Benny looks at the rose through world-colored glasses.
That's wonderful.
I don't know how many people think of you as a great composer of choral music, but there are some wonderful choral cues throughout your career. You seem to enjoy very much writing for the human voice, for the massed human voices.
Yes, there have been some opportunities, Jim, to do that. I was particularly fond of Dry Your Tears, Africa, Your Children Are Coming Home, which is a piece from Amistad. Are acquitted before the Supreme Court, actually defended by no one less than John Quincy Adams, and they were given permission to return to Africa. Children were all dressed in white, and they boarded a ship to go home. And I had no idea what kind of a text might be used, or where one might discover something, or how to write something appropriate. And I asked a friend of mine in Boston, Susie Dangle, to go over to the Boston Library and see what you could find out about African poetry, or some reference. And two or three pages into the book, there was a poem by an African writer, the title of which was Dry Your Tears, Africa, Your Children Are Coming Home. And it was written in French, translated into English. And Susie took the French and English versions to the Nigerian embassy in Washington, where it was translated into the appropriate tribal language of Africa. I think it was Liberia, I believe that's right. And into the English that we have here. And it involves adult chorus, but is principally established by the children themselves. And the Los Angeles Children's Choir performs the piece. And they've done it before with me at the Hollywood Bowl, and they do it so very well. So that was a unique opportunity that this particular film, Amistad, which I'm now beginning to remember very well, to write something for children, for chorus. Another opportunity for children, of course, was Home Alone with the children's chorus in that piece. I haven't written very much choral music other than in film, Jim, but I've always enjoyed it. Probably 6, 7 in total in my entire career for voices. Woefully small number.
Yeah, but they're all pretty choice. That great moment, well, a couple of great moments in Empire of the Sun, Cadillac of the Skies.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. There's some voices in Empire, yeah.
And the end title music from Saving Private Ryan, the principal reason that I tell people, never leave a movie until the end credits are over, because if you walked out on Saving Private Ryan, I can't imagine anyone doing it, they would miss Hymn to the Fallen, which is an intensely moving farewell to all of those guys.
What a great film, Jim, that is, Saving Private Ryan. What a moving experience. The choral ending, I think, offers us an opportunity to reflect on the film itself and in a quiet, personal, subjective way. We had the Tanglewood Festival chorus in Boston recorded initially. This chorus and Los Angeles chorus did it very well. Also, Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, and in a very subjective, personal way, that's the movie that finally explained to me what my dad did on that day.
Yes, it must have been particularly affecting to you.
It was, totally. Yeah. Totally. I think one of his great
Did your father see the film?
No, he didn't. Okay. He didn't live to see it. I wish he had. You did Schindler's List and Jurassic Park in the same year.
Yes.
Two more different films, kind of hard to imagine.
Well, with Steven Spielberg, I can never tell what's coming next. You know, Jim, I don't remember which one came first, actually. Of course, I did know the book of Schindler's List. The book, I think I'd read that. It had been around a year or two before Steven had decided to make it. Talk about a variety in a musical diet. A great thing, really, to be able to be playing around with dinosaurs and scaring the children of the world, and then making a quick turn into the subject of Schindler's List, which couldn't be more touching, more serious, more challenging, actually, to get just right. Jurassic Park, I have to say, the point of challenge, a lot easier, much more straightforward, fun. Schindler's List I haven't seen in all those years. But the subject and the opportunity was something that actually took me quite a good while. I wrote the theme that we now associate with when we hear Schindler's List was preceded by two or three others. And it was one that I actually we've recorded, which is called Remembrances, which I initially thought was a stronger theme for the film. Stephen kept saying, no, I think the other one, like the other one better, and back and forth and so on. Also, we'd chosen Itzhak Perlman to play whatever music I'd written for violin. So we had him as a subject and an interpreter before we had any music at all on the page. And I really think it was a great help to me. Knowing him and knowing his spirit through the years as I did was a help for me to get the idea of Jewish music, as I understood it, music of that part of Eastern Europe, as distinct from Jewish music perhaps in Spain or in the Near East or other places in the world. I had known Itzhak, I think, for about 20 years before that opportunity came, the opportunity of Schindler's List. And whenever I saw Itzhak at a concert or anywhere, he would say to me, John, when are you going to write me into one of your films? And I said, Itzhak, as soon as the opportunity comes, if it ever comes, I will give you a call first. So I looked at Schindler's List and said, Stephen, we need a violin for this, for reasons I had to do with a violin playing actor in the film, which was cut from the film. So we knew we needed a violin. We agreed that we would call Itzhak. So after 20 years of his cajoling about this, I called Itzhak and said, there's a film, I'd like you to play the violin solo. He said, well, I don't know if I want to do a film. What is it? What is it about? I said, Itzhak, I think you want to do this film. Oh, okay, I'll do it. So he came to Symphony Hall in Boston to rehearse with me at the piano. I'd written, you know, and show him a clip or two of the film. And he watched one scene. He said, just turn it off. I can't see it. It's too affecting and too touching and strong. Let's just play. The next day the orchestra came and he didn't look at the film at all. I had a monitor where he just played and contributed enormously, I think, to the soundtrack of that film. He brought to it his artistry and his spirit.
Yeah. A tough picture to write the score for. I would think so.
Yes.
Because Ben Kingsley once said, Gandhi was nothing. He just put on the makeup. He went and did it. Mm-hmm. He said Schindler cost him every day. It was a tough picture to make. Mm-hmm. He's prouder of that than anything he's ever done, mm-hmm. including Gandhi. But it was hard. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard thing.
It would be interesting to see the film again. I remember it as being so perfect as I watched it working on it. Each frame seemed to be so beautifully composed. You couldn't find one of the actors on the side or in the back where the eyes weren't just right or where the expression wasn't. Not only in lighting, but in what people brought to it. And I think Stephen was saying nobody was acting. They were all living this experience.
And one critic, I can't remember who it was who said it, but you know, I wish I could, because it was a very perceptive thing to say. He said the pacing of the film is exactly like Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, it moves so fast, but is also very contemplative at the same time. It's one of these bits of alchemy that only somebody like Spielberg can understand how it works.
Yeah. I don't think any music could be good enough to satisfy that role and that requirement. I've told you this story before, Jim. You listen to this, so I don't know if I can repeat it to you.
Please do.
When Stephen and I first looked at the film to discuss music, we sat in the room and ran the film. At the end of it, I was so moved. As the lights came up, I really couldn't speak. I just said, Stephen, excuse me, I'll go up. And I walked around for 5 minutes outside the building and catch my breath and recover and return to the room and begin to talk about our musical approach to the film. And I said to Stephen, and meant it completely, I said, Stephen, you need a better composer than I am for this film. And he said very sweetly, I know, but they're all dead.
Yes, exactly.
It is in that mood and that atmosphere that I came to this thinking, how can anybody satisfy this at a level? It could be done so many ways, so many wonderful ways, by magnificent people, past, present, future. I can only hope that it's adequate.
It's that and then some. So when I first saw Jurassic Park, I was actually reviewing movies for CBS. So I went to the screening on the Warner's lot, and boy, did it scare the, you know what I mean. It's just, and it's also a wonderfully hilarious movie, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just.
I have seen it recently. Stephen and I ran it. The purpose of that was just to make some adjustments technically for some new releases that he had planned. And we looked at each other and said, well, that was better than we thought, wasn't it, so many years ago. It's a wonderful program, I think, at least all children should see. And I think it was even more wonderful when it came out in 1992 or 3 or 4, somewhere in there, when the technology had emerged in the way that it did, that we could see these monsters and experience all of this done so very well. It wasn't possible to do any of that when Star Wars was made. George was still using models, and like we talked earlier with the E.T., with the little rubber man. The technology was wonderful at that point, but we've advanced greatly since then. But Jurassic Park, I think, still looks very good. And I always think that it's something I would have wanted my kids to see at the right age, to learn a little more about ourselves and the histories of these curious creatures, mammals.
Exactly. The way, you know, you could see the muscles underneath the brontosaurus rippling as he's walking underneath the skin.
Yes.
I spent a little time on that, I would think. Well, on the new album, the one recorded at Rice Hall over a couple of days, not too long ago, there's a sequence of cues which I think illustrate how a film composer has to be versatile. Because what Warhorse, The Terminal, and Munich have in common are basically, you know, you and Steven Spielberg, and that's it. Warhorse, I'm a big animal lover. And for anyone who loves quadrupeds, I mean, it was just such a touching, moving movie. Mm-hmm. Plus, the First World War is one of my major areas of interest. I mean, it's, I think, the event that made the modern world and changed everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was it a hard film to write?
Oh, very difficult film, I think. I have the same interest that you do, and so many of us do, about the period of the first early decades of the last century, the changes that it created so dramatically. To begin with, musically, with the film, I wanted to try to create the atmosphere of the second decade of that and then allude to the British pastoral style of the time, done so beautifully by so many people. We remember Vaughan Williams himself, of course, but Cyril Scott and Delius and so many others whose names will escape me at the moment. And I've also, at this advanced stage, become a horse lover. And that has happened because I have a place up in Santa Ynez Valley exactly contiguous to Monty Roberts, who's the great horse whisperer, as you may know.
Oh, yeah.
And at the present time, he's in London with the Queen of England. He's worked with her and her horses for many, many decades now. And there's a wonderful story about Warhorse. When Stephen went to show the film to the Queen, who was a horse lover, as everybody knows, she said to him she would agree to look at the film as long as none of the horses were hurt. And Stephen assured her that none of the animals had been mistreated or hurt in any way, which I guess we have to accept as being fact. But for anyone interested in horses or interested in the First World War or interested in the British pastoral musical style, they may find some interest in this film. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. The cue called Dartmoor, that's what it's like.
Ah, good.
I mean, it's exactly like that. It's like. And following that, the very curious film called The Terminal, Tom Hanks, I think, one of his best
yes.
performances. The guy's stuck in an airport.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to kind of flex semi-klezmer muscles in this particular cue.
Well, the story about this performance especially, Jim, is this, that we gathered at Royce Hall to make these recordings for this collection, and I hadn't included the terminal, Victor's Tale, which is a piece for clarinet and orchestra. And close to the end of one of the morning sessions, Stephen said, "Aren't we doing Victor's Tale?" And I said, "No, Stephen, I hadn't included that." He said, "Well, can we? Do you think we can?"
That's a clarinetist talking.
So, yes, that's right. Stephen, if your listeners will know that some of them, Stephen played clarinet. So I said, "Well, Stephen, I don't know. We don't have the music here. I live very close to the Royce Hall, and I asked my librarian, Karen Smith, to go to the house and bring the music for Victor's Tale over, and we'll ask Don Foster, our principal clarinetist, if he can play it at sight or, after the noon break." So he said, "Yes, I think I can do it." And I asked some friends at the noon break, was Don practicing his part or not? The music had arrived. He said, no, he just went off to lunch somewhere. I think we did a rehearsal and a take or two or three at the most, and he played it perfectly. I think he brought a wonderful character to the piece. It's not a caricature. It doesn't make fun of itself, which easily it could or be overdone in some stylistic way. The first performance of that was done by the late Emily Bernstein, who was a fabulous clarinetist from Eastman that came and played with us. And she also captured the spirit of this without making it a joke. It's funny enough as it is. You just play it in a serious way, and then it becomes fun.
Yeah.
And Don has accomplished that, I think, so brilliantly. The second person that I, other than Emily Bernstein, to have recorded this piece, I believe.
Yeah. And then we're going to follow that with music from that picture. The same year you wrote the score for Munich was the year you did Memoirs of a Geisha. And talk about disparate things. In Munich, another very powerful film.
Music is a very, very powerful thing. There's just, some scenes in the end that I've needed to look at recently that are very, very hard to watch. A powerful piece. There's an adaptation for guitar that I've done that people have done very beautifully. Some recordings sent to me from that. And what we've played here is an adaptation of the main theme from the film for a string orchestra, which I haven't performed very much, but it seemed to belong in this collection of Spielberg film music.
Sure. So you're in the midst of the new Star Wars picture.
Yes.
Writing it and recording it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of more Steven Spielberg projects down the line. They've at least been announced. So, in other words, you're a pretty busy guy these days.
Very busy, Jim, yes. A few concerts. I will go to Boston in May and make my annual visit to the Pops and to Tanglewood and the Bowl here. But very busy writing. The new Star Wars, which is The Last Jedi, is a continuation, really, of Force Awakens. And it has some new cast members, but we still have Daisy Ridley, my favorite, and Stephen has many projects coming ahead, so I will keep up with him as long as I can. Now, he's a much younger man than I am, and I think he expects me to go on forever with him. His father reached 100 recently, and he worked till he was 95, I think.
Yeah, and his mom, who just passed away, was, what, 97?
I think she was. So I think Stephen is expecting me to work till I'm 95. We'll just see. He's a very young man.
Well, I mean, he's always been kind of this, we didn't play anything from Hook, but it's no accident that he made a movie about Peter Pan.
Yes, that's true, true enough.
Yeah. After all these years, does it ever get anything other than exciting working with a guy like this? He's kind of a Winston Churchill in the sense that he's a guy out of whom ideas just come popping. One after another.
He's an amazing, amazing man. And he still has his childish enthusiasm and sense of newness of things. Leonard Bernstein was always saying to us, try to stay in touch with the 8-year-old that was there, the sense of wonder and magic and so on. Stephen has got that and much more. And he's been an inspiring man to work with. Others also, I have to say, Chris Columbus, so I've done a few films with Harry Potter and Home Alone and another one or two. Recently, I've been thinking about Oliver Stone. I think I'd like to say hello to Oliver. I don't know what he's doing right now, but he's done some fabulous films. I have three with him, and George Lucas, of course. But Stephen and I have had a special connection somehow, in which I'd be at pains to try to explain it. There's a comfort there of working together, like a good marriage, where a lot of things don't need to be said or reiterated, and we get to the point of the matter maybe more quickly, or sympathetic temperaments in some way. In any case, it's been exciting, it's been a privilege, and I hope there'll be some more.
Yeah, and among the great directors, you know, some of them, you know, there are some that didn't quite understand what music was all about. William Wyler, with whom you worked, you know, toward the end of his career, he was going to throw out Hugo Friedhofer's score for The Best Years of Our Lives because the person he talked to most recently said, it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And Dave Raxon stepped in. He said, no, keep it in. It's going to win the Oscar, which it did. Mm-hmm. Spielberg is the kind of guy, one of those rare directors, who really understands what music can do. Mm-hmm. And he also has the sense to let his composer do what he can do, which not all of them do.
That's very true, Jim. He is enamored with the orchestra per se. He will come to our recording sessions and sit and imbibe the music with such sensual pleasure almost. I don't think he's an avid concert goer now. I think he's just too busy. But he loves music. He's been taking photographs of the members of our orchestra for years and years. And we'll ask one violinist, how is the baby now? Well, the baby's 23 now. This kind of thing. And he's got a library of every recording session we've ever done. I wonder sometimes what he will do with all that footage. The happiest day in his working year, I think I can safely say, is the day on which we record the score for one of his movies. He always says, and I believe it, that he makes movies so that he can come to the scoring stage and hear the music. Now, what better kind of companion can the composer have? If the session is supposed to be 3 hours and we make it four or five, he's happy. It can go on all day, all night, as far as he's concerned. There is no overtime with him. At the end of 3 or 6 hours, his question will be, what else have we got we can play? And maybe someone has a Suppé overture in the car we could just read.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, so it's more than a collaboration. It's a situation where we've both been truly, as silly maybe as it may sound, having great fun doing all of this.
Oh, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. Well, a souvenir of that great relationship, just issued by Sony. It's called John William Steven Spielberg, The Ultimate Collection. 3 CDs plus a wonderful DVD. It's a documentary made as the recordings were being made. It's illuminating and fun. And Steven Spielberg, you know, like an anxious, excited young kid.
Well, Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Always a great pleasure to see you, and thanks for the invitation. Thank you.